This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Breaking sports tradition. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
President Trump's approach to professional athletes is much different than his predecessors. We'll explain how.
New trend on the workout scene, gyms that bring in healthy meals.
The hottest private club in Hollywood these days is an American Legion post that's been made over by younger vets.
And TSA is going the wrong way with customer service.
I thought that they were getting their act together, and it turns out that there are more complaints being recorded against the TSA. This is according to TSA's own numbers than there were in the past.
Travel expert Chris Elliott on how to deal with rude TSA agents. He's here later in the hour. Ever since President Carter invited the NBA's Washington Bullets to the White House in 1978, presidents of both parties have used the White House to celebrate championship teams as the embodiment of American virtues of teamwork, determination, and diversity. But President Trump's recent dust-ups with athletes who took a knee during the national anthem have jeopardized that tradition as the event has become wrapped in cultural wars. Here's USA Today White House correspondent Gregory Cordy. Gregory, what have you found?
The presidents have had sports teams in the White House going back all the way. The earliest recorded instance we can find of this is Andrew Johnson. Right after the Civil War, he invited the Atlantics.
Okay.
And the Washington Nationals. These were two amateur baseball teams.
Wow.
And, you know, Coolidge had the Washington Senators in, President Kennedy had the Boston Celtics in, but it really materialized under President Carter. He had the Washington Bullets in after they won the NBA championship. He had the Pirates and the Steelers in. They, of course, Pittsburgh had that great sports year, 1979.
Yep.
And then it just sort of took hold. You know, President Reagan loved a good sports story. He's a former news sportscaster, as you know. You know, he couldn't resist the whole win one for the Gipper mythology of his own sort of campaign. And so each president since then has sort of expanded them into women's sports, college sports, Olympic sports, until it's now become an institution. President Obama had six or eight just in his last year in office of these kinds of ceremonies. And presidents like them because, A, you know, who doesn't like to meet with your sports heroes? But also it's a great opportunity as president to sort of associate yourself with a winning team.
Yeah, yeah.
And to talk about these American values of teamwork and hard work and dedication and inclusiveness that sports provides the perfect metaphor for.
So along comes President Trump and seems to have turned that all upside down, which I guess to a certain extent may be what some of his supporters appreciate.
Yeah, well, so, you know, we're living in a highly politicized era where it's hard to separate the president as the head of state, as the president of all of the United States, with the policies and politics that he has. You know, Steph Curry, of the Golden State Warriors, expressed some hesitation about going to the White House. The president, President Trump, rescinded the invitation. And so that, in combination with all of these NFL national anthem protests we're seeing, I think it's going to make it really hard for a sports team to show up at the White House now. And so we'll just have to see. The Pittsburgh Penguins, a hockey team, which incidentally probably has more Canadians than Americans on it, it says that they're still coming to the White House.
Yeah.
To celebrate their Stanley Cup victory. But we're just going to have to see whether this is a tradition that can survive the Trump administration wholly intact.
We're speaking with Gregory Cordy, White House correspondent at USA Today. His piece is called Trump's Approach to Sports Breaks with Long Bipartisan Tradition. I thought the Pittsburgh Penguins approach really just it cut out all the controversy and the kind of the statement they made, saying right with something along the lines of we respect the White House as an institution. Politics are aside. We're simply making a visit to celebrate our, you know, Lord Stanley's trophy or something like that.
Yeah, and that's sort of traditionally what these ceremonies are about. And there's a bipartisan tradition here. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the 80s came to the White House and pretty much said, "You look, I'm not, it's no secret, I'm not a Republican. I don't necessarily agree with President Reagan's policies, but hey, you know, we're also all Americans, and I, you know, appreciate the gesture. And, you know, maybe that sort of respect for the office of the president is a bygone era, a bygone idea, the era of Trump. And, you know, look, it's an open question, and obviously I think people can debate this ad nauseum. Who is to blame for that? Is that President Trump? Who has diminished the respect for the presidency, or is it, you know, people, I think, you know, from Trump's perspective, he would argue that they're professional athletes who just oppose him, this sort of resist movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, may also, but all of this comes from just an increasing polarization in American politics.
Yeah. The disinvite from the president to the Golden State Warriors, has that been done before?
Never, so far as you know, and I've talked to a couple of experts on this. No one can remember a time when a president has disinvited, issued that kind of disinvite. But, you know, the president has disinvited himself this year from the White House Correspondents' Dinner,
oh, yeah,
from the Kennedy Center Honors. There are a lot of these, it's not just sports, it's a lot of these other sort of cultural and political events, Washington events, that the president has said, you know, I'd be uncomfortable. There are people there who obviously oppose me. I just, to make it less awkward for all involved, I think I'm going to stay home.
That's USA Today White House correspondent Gregory Cordy. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Teens have lower adoption rates than younger children and often wait longer to be adopted, yet they still need and want the love and support of a family. That's part of a new awareness campaign from groups like the Adoptive Exchange Association. More on the latest effort from CEO Camila Bunn, whose organization is based in Maryland. It's called What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Camila, explain the campaign.
The HHS, Health and Human Services, Ag Council, and Adopt U.S. Kids are pleased to be launching a brand new set and series of public service announcements encouraging prospective parents to consider adopting teens out of the foster care system. Across the country, we have over 420,000 children who are in the foster care system, and 112,000 of them are waiting to be adopted. We have a large percentage, a large number of those children who are waiting are teens. So our campaign is focused on finding homes for the children most at need.
Boy, those are big numbers. What for the teenagers? Is it the older they get as a child, does it become more difficult to find homes for them?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of some things. The first being that when people set out on their journey to adopt, often they're considering younger children. And that's one of the things that we're hoping to do with our campaign is really promote the idea of adopting a teenager. I call them the terrific teens because they are really phenomenal young people who are very resilient and truly in need of families. The other misconception that we find quite often, which prevents some people from considering adopting an older youth, is that the misconception that these young people have done something wrong to be in foster care, or they're, you know, have done something, and that is not the truth. These young people are in the foster care system due to no fault of their own, and so we're hoping that the campaign will dispel myths, will have and encourage people and inspire people to envision themselves parenting one of these young people who are really phenomenal and very resilient, wonderful kids.
I know you mentioned before you talked about prospective parents, maybe those thinking of having a child on their own. What about seasoned parents who've, you know, have had a couple of kids already, and I don't know, maybe they're empty nesters and you know, are willing to take one in?
Yes, we are absolutely out there hoping that whether you're married, you're couples, you have children or have no children, that you do consider parenting an older teen and adopting out of the foster care system. We have a website with lots of information. It's adoptuskids.org. So for those who are listening to us and maybe considering it, definitely encourage them to go to our website and read a little bit more about it. If you prefer to speak with a live person, we have professionals who answer our 800 number and are happy and very devoted to the families who contact them to learn more about the process, and they will handhold you, in fact, beyond the original phone call, even through as you're going through the process to adopt as well. They'll support you. And that number is 888-200-4005. And we have folks waiting by the phone to hear from you.
We're speaking with Camila Bunn, CEO of Adoptive Exchange Association, talking about their new awareness campaign focused on adopting teenagers. What would you say is the biggest selling point when, you know, when you get 30 seconds to promote the idea? What do you typically tell people?
I talk about the milestones that our young people have yet to reach. It is true that when you're adopting a teenager, they have experienced other things. You know, they have already walked, they have already talked, you know, they've already gone through those early milestones. But we still need our parents in our lives when we're going off to college, when we're graduating from high school, when we are playing in a ball game and we need someone to cheer us on. And we definitely want to encourage parents to envision themselves parenting a young person. Think about their own childhood and the importance of having someone there to support them. That's what we want for our children. All children deserve a family.
It's Camila Bunn, CEO of the Adoptive Exchange Association based in Maryland. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, what's trending at the gym? Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us as we transfer from September to October. For exercisers short on time, services are stocking gym fridges with ready-to-go preservative-free meals. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you work out hard, you also, of course, have to eat. Recognizing that, more and more gyms are offering healthy takeout. With more on this trend, Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, how did this all start?
Well, I think it really has started from the desire of people to eat much more healthily, and really people, as you probably have seen, have gotten much more particular about what they eat and more to the point what they don't eat, you know, cutting up preservatives and certain whole food groups like dairy and so on. And so I think people realized, especially people who were working out, that if they didn't kind of marry these two practices, eating well and exercising, then they were going to shortchange their overall health. So gyms have started responding to this. And in fact, a lot of these services are actually not connected to the gyms. They're independent, but they have started dropping off these meals where their clients often visit, which is the gym.
I was going to say at my gym, they're into the smoothie thing, but it's the same people working the desk who are making the food, and there are long lines and it never seems to work out. So now they're bringing it in.
Yes, that's true. And in a lot of cases, what these services do is they make fresh meals. They're typically not frozen, and people can order them online ahead of time, and then they'll deliver the meals to the gym, often even providing the gym with a fridge to hold these meals. And so someone who belongs to the gym can order these meals and pick up, you know, say, lunches and dinners, for instance, for the entire week, and just pick them out of the fridge and take them home. So it's really kind of a marriage of convenience.
Rachel, what are we talking about in terms of cost?
Well, it does vary, of course. Some of the higher-end services can cost, you know, $18 or $19 for a really elaborate dinner entree. But a lot of these are surprisingly affordable. You know, you can get breakfast or kind of a small version of lunch for about $8 or $9. Most of them were between about $10 and $13 for, you know, for a decent-sized dinner entree. But that was a complete entree, you know, with a vegetable and, if you want it, some kind of starch and a protein. One of the things people like about these meals is that they often have really specific ingredients lists that tell you exactly what's in them, and then they'll have what people call the macros, the macronutrients, the percentage of carbohydrates, protein and fat. A lot of people are tracking those now, so it's very convenient, they say, to have them listed right on the meal.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, is this just kind of a foo-foo gym kind of thing, or is it happening everywhere?
You know, it really is surprisingly widespread. I did talk to a large health club chain, Lifetime, that is revamping a service like this that they started a couple of years ago. They're expanding it considerably. So that's certainly nationwide. I talked to a gym in Paducah, Kentucky, that says these meals are very popular. About a quarter of their members buy them, including seniors who are budget conscious and have figured out that they can eat half of one dinner and save the rest of it and eat the rest of it the next day. So, you know, it's really quite a varied clientele. I think the common denominator is people who care about their health and are going to the gym.
They certainly would also have to have the room to do this. And are there concerns at all about handling food or food safety for people who aren't really used to handling the food, or because it's prepackaged, they don't have to worry about it too much?
They generally do come in their own packages. A lot of these services actually ship these meals directly to people at home, and I think that's going to grow quite a bit. But in general, they do come packaged. In fact, they come sort of double packaged sometimes. If you order, say, 10 meals, they'll be packaged individually, and then they'll also be, you know, tied up in a bag so that when someone goes to the gym, they can see, you know, a bag with their name on it. And so the people at the gym are generally not handling the food at all. Not even the actual meal package. So I haven't heard any concerns about that. Although these meals generally, as I mentioned, are fresh, and so they do need to be eaten typically within a couple of days or frozen.
Thanks, Rachel. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. How would you like the convenience of joining a group cycling class whenever you want, right in your own home? Skip the commute to the gym, join live rides on the Peloton indoor cycling bike, or choose a ride on demand based on your favorite music. You can even choose your favorite world-class instructor. There are also dozens of on-demand scenic rides and additional off-bike workouts. The Peloton bike includes a 22-inch high-def touchscreen, performance tracking metrics, and a real-time leaderboard. In fact, see if you're working harder than me. My screen name is Radio Guy Gordon. Discover this cutting-edge indoor cycling bike that brings the studio experience to your home. Peloton is offering listeners a limited-time offer. Go to PelotonCycle.com, enter the code GORDONDEAL at checkout, and get 20% off accessories with your Peloton bike purchase. Get a great workout at home anytime you want. Go to PelotonCycle.com, use the code GORDONDEAL, and get started. Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, Puerto Rico's power woes. Also, dealing with rude TSA agents, plus the new bride that's causing upheaval in the wedding industry, and Hollywood's private club is in an American Legion post. We'll explain in about 20 minutes. Well, as residents of Puerto Rico cope with power outages across the entire island, the task of turning the lights back on falls to an electrical utility saddled with rickety infrastructure, workforce reductions, and financial troubles so deep it actually declared a form of bankruptcy this past summer. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Ariane Campo Flores. Ariane, help us understand the magnitude.
Yeah, well, the scope of the problem is enormous. When Irma hit the island, it basically sideswiped Puerto Rico. It kind of skirted to the north of the island. And even still, with that, it knocked out power to about 70% of the electric utility's customers. So they had a couple of weeks there where they were trying to bring people back online, and they made significant strides. And then Maria came, and obviously Maria was a direct hit, a very, very strong storm, and it wiped out power to 100% of the utility's customers. It knocked down transmission lines, the distribution system. And so we're looking now at a situation where it will very likely take months for power to be restored to the island's residents.
Boy, and even the, I guess what I would consider something simple, like as you point out in the story, the FEMA director said they don't even have telephone poles stored. Like they got to bring them in.
Right. I mean, that's the challenge when you're dealing with an island. You know, we saw in Florida in the wake of Hurricane Irma just how effectively utilities were able to just send in convoys of bucket trucks and other equipment to be able to respond quickly and get people back online. Virtually all of Florida has now electricity restored. But in Puerto Rico, you know, it's an island. It's a small island. And so what the FEMA administrator was explaining to me is that some significant, you know, large pieces of equipment, like, you know, those enormous poles that they need to hold up lines, are not stored there. And so that needs to get shipped in. But it's so that's going to take some time, and obviously there's a lot of need, a lot of supplies that need to get shipped in, from food to water to cots to other equipment like generators. So it's going to be a while before they can even get the equipment in place to start repairing the system.
Wow. And beyond that, as you point out in the story, this is decades in the making. How come?
Well, you know, the electric utility in Puerto Rico has long been a source of frustration and complaints for residents of the island. It's a government-owned monopoly. It has been criticized in report after report for being inefficient and bloated and poorly managed over the years. It has accumulated so much debt, $9 billion worth of debt, that declared a form of bankruptcy in July. That is on, you know, along with the island as a whole having declared bankruptcy, and because of its financial straits, it hasn't been able to invest in the kinds of maintenance that it should have been in recent years. It has also had to reduce its workforce, so it doesn't have as many personnel as it needs, particularly now as it's they're trying to bring people back online. And so this is just it's a utility that has just long been beset by significant problems, and now it is facing this Herculean task, and it's hamstrung.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Arian Campo Flores. His piece is called "Puerto Rico's Power Woes Are Decades in the Making." I think there was one woman quoted in your story who said she's saying they might not have power before Christmas.
I think that's the attitude of a lot of residents of the island. I mean, you know, for them, power outages are not uncommon. There was a fire that occurred at a plant last year that knocked out power for days to people. You know, people in the wake of Hurricane Irma, there were some that never got their power restored, and then Maria came. So, you know, people are accustomed to it. They know about the fragile state of the electric grid there. And given the enormity of the task that they face now in rebuilding that system, I think people are just resigned to the fact that this is just going to be months and months of a really uncomfortable slog while the utility gets things back online.
What a mess. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Arian Campo Flores. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. I'm glad you're with us. TSA agents apparently are getting ruder, and it's time to do something about it. So say an increasing number of air travelers, citing their own experiences of being harassed and harangued by the screeners who are supposed to be helping them. Travel expert and consumer advocate Christopher Elliott has written about it and joins us now. Chris, I thought TSA has improved.
No, I was surprised too, because I thought that they were getting their act together, and it turns out that there are more complaints being recorded against the TSA. This is according to TSA's own numbers than there were in the past. So, either more people are complaining or more agents are being unpleasant to travelers.
Mm. Anybody,
or maybe both.
Anybody take a guess as to why? They're just unhappy with the job, or what's going on there?
Yeah, well, one thing is that surveys have been done about the morale at the TSA, and it is, I believe, the third worst federal agency to work for, behind, I think, the Secret Service and the IRS, if I'm not mistaken. And so, so people are... they're not happy at work, and that sometimes just comes through.
I guess sometimes there's no explanation for what the TSA is doing, right? You've talked about this woman, Karen Kemp, this graphic designer from Charlotte, North Carolina, like an agent just kind of rifled through the cash in her purse or something?
Yeah, well, they don't have to explain themselves, and they don't feel the need to explain themselves. So sometimes when they see something that looks suspicious, they will ask you to open your bag. I mean, this just happened to me yesterday when I was flying. And they won't tell you what they're seeing. And sometimes they're not, their manners are not that good. They'll maybe rifle through, and then they won't help you repack, or they won't put it back the way that they saw it.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of rubs people the wrong way. So that might be one of the sources of complaints, is just people, the agents, just not being courteous.
Yeah. So what's involved here? Is better training or better job at hiring the folks in the first place?
It's really hard to find good people. And, at one point the TSA was advertising for jobs on the back of pizza boxes. Huh. And so they really are scraping the bottom of the barrel in some cases. So I think that's one of the issues, is how do you recruit someone to work for the TSA when you have such a bad reputation? And then training, of course, too. There are limited resources, and you're training them, obviously, to do a job, which is to find things that people shouldn't be taking on the plane with them. And adding manners and courtesy to it. Now, I did talk to TSA, and they said that they train them on how to deal with the public and what is and what isn't courteous. But, these are some things that their parents should have taught them. And so if you find someone whose parents didn't teach them manners, chances are the TSA isn't going to do any better.
Thanks, Chris. That's travel expert and consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Weekend, small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Hey, glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. There's a new approach to weddings these days, and it's coming from a nonconformist bride known as Bridechilla. And she's turning the industry upside down. Here's how, from MarketWatch reporter Jillian Berman. Jillian, who is Bridechilla?
Essentially, these are women who, sort of eschew some of the traditional trappings of a wedding, like chair covers or inner envelopes, to do something that's a little more custom or seemingly at least a little more chill.
I had forgotten about this. Explain what the inner envelope is.
Yeah, so sometimes when you receive an invitation, there's an envelope on the outside that has that has the address, and then inside of that envelope, there's another envelope that actually contains the invitation inside. And so this is kind of, an old school formal invitation tradition. But a lot of people these days say, just because people have always done it this way doesn't mean that I need to do it this way.
Okay. Well, what else do these brides do differently?
Some things that they're doing differently are, for example, they're dropping that, or just, really trying to not get too caught up in obsessing over various details. So I mentioned the chair cover example. So for a lot of weddings, you have these chairs, and they can come with different covers on top, and a lot of people think really hard about that. But for many, that's not important. So trying to recognize if that's you, that you don't need to obsess over it, or things like favors, which, over the past, several years have become kind of an expectation at many weddings.
Yeah.
But some of the brides I spoke to said, that's not really meaningful to me. I would rather just donate money in honor of my guests or, you know, just not have that at all.
Where's this coming from, by the way?
So it's coming from a few different places. You know, one is actually a podcast that launched a few years ago and is using the name Bridechilla. So a lot of, you know, sort of energy around this, you know, this idea of nonconformity or not obsessing over, you know, certain traditional things has kind of found a home with the podcast and a Facebook group associated with it. But the term has been around for longer than the podcast. And one wedding planner I spoke to said, she kind of pins it to the Great Recession when people, you know, their budgets were constrained. And so they said, you know, I don't need to keep up with the Joneses, and kind of found a way to embrace the idea of not keeping up with the Joneses.
So are bridechillas saving money through their wedding approaches?
Not necessarily. So, in some cases, bridechilla can sort of mean DIY brides, another, you know, kind of popular trend where people, you know, make their own centerpieces and things like that. But in other cases, it just means actually having a wedding that is easier to plan. And a lot of times that actually costs more money.
Thanks, Jillian. Jillian Berman, Market Watch reporter based in New York. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. By the way, if you want, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can look us up on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username @GordonDeal. Coming up next, the coolest private club in Hollywood. Thanks for spending time with us. The coolest private club in Hollywood these days is inside American Legion Post 43, thanks to a new generation of combat veterans. Post Commander Fernando Rivero, a TV producer and Afghanistan vet, says they've got the cheapest drinks, the nicest people, the best-looking bar, and free parking. In 2014, Mr. Rivero and seven other members drew up a party ticket and challenged the old guard in elections for leadership positions. These are mostly post-9/11 veterans. They used email and texting to summon votes, and they won. Their first move was to set a goal of doubling the roles to 1,000 members by 2019. Suddenly, the bar opened more than one night a week. There was live music. They held barbecues on the plaza in front of the building where passing vets could see signs of life and inquire about membership. Next project, converting the big meeting hall into a 482-seat digital movie theater where they can screen, of course, military movies. Resistance to this, by the way, has been fairly light. Jimmy Weldon, who's 94 and helped liberate Buchenwald, says, quote, "It's going to make Grauman's Chinese Theater look like a second-rate place." That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.